Good evening. Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. My name is Dan Shustak, your host for this spring seminar series. This annual lecture series is funded by MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lecture will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. Tonight's presentation will last about 45 minutes. You are invited to ask questions during the presentation, and we will also have time at the end for questions and answers. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Judith Peterson. Dr. Peterson is a research affiliate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Sea Grant College Program. As a marine ecologist, her research interests and publications cover topics related to coastal pollution, marine biological invasions, regional research, and the U.S. and Canadian collaborations in the Gulf of Maine, and more recently, climate change impacts on coastal ecosystems, including impacts on native and non-native marine organisms. She organized several rapid assessment surveys where taxonomic experts identified native and non-native marine organisms found in marinas and harbors throughout New England. Dr. Peterson has convened several international conferences on marine bioinvasions and ballast water, served as chair of the International Council for the Exploration of the Seas Working Group on Introductions and Transfers of Marine Organisms and the Northeast Aquatic Nuisance Species Panel, and is a member of an external review board for the Puerto Rico Center for the Environment and Neuroscience. She has served as an external advisor to Canadian agencies on marine bioinvasion issues and as an editor for the scientific journal Estuaries. Her publications include journal articles, public outreach documents, and several special editions of journals for which she was guest editor. She has received awards, including ones from the Gulf of Maine Council for the Marine Environment, an International Council for the Exploration of the Seas, Save the Harbor, Save the Bay, and the Massachusetts Bays Program, among others. Please help me welcome Dr. Peterson to MCLA.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Dan, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here and a privilege to meet all the students and the guests. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have been to the marine, spent some time on the coast? Oh, good. All right. So I hope you'll forgive me if I've sort of given some general things that probably a lot of you already know. I wasn't sure who the audience exactly would be, but we'll start with that. So I've chosen a theme, The Times They Are a Change, and thank you, Bob Dylan. And we're looking at non-native species as well as some climate change impacts. And primarily we'll be focusing on the Northeast. But in fact, as Dan already mentioned, marine bioinvasions are global. And we'll talk a little bit about how that works together. And then we also will be talking about, I have a problem here because my eyes are, I need cataract surgery. So forgive me if I can't always read what I'm talking about. We'll talk about vectors. We're going to talk about impacts. And I'm going to use some of the work that we did with our rapid assessment surveys to let you know about the specific species that we have seen in the Northeast and their impacts. And then we'll talk a little bit about climate change and end with some discussion on bioinvasion security. But the maxim, and usually you don't say really strong things in the marine or in science, but the maxim is, you know, if you have marine organisms that become established, it's almost virtually impossible to get rid of them. So what does that tell you? The biggest thing that we should be doing if we want to take care of invasive species is to prevent them. Before we begin, I also like to give a definition of what we call marine non-native species. Sometimes it differs a little bit among the different types of terrestrial or freshwater scientists. We call anything that comes into the area a non-native species. Doesn't matter what time it arrived. Could have come in with the Vikings in the 1200s or it could be a very recent invasion. It still is a non-native species. We also, the indigenous species are the indigenous species. We also have a group we call cryptogenic. Those are organisms that might have come from Europe long before we were taking keeping records, or after, or went back the other way. We have no idea. You need molecular studies to sort of separate these, and we aren't at that point yet. So we're going to just call those native. You know, I usually like to start out talking about why we care. We care because they have economic costs, public health costs, and ecological costs. Now, my interests are in the latter. Worked at the state long enough to know that the state cares about, the politicians at least, care about the economic costs and the public health costs. So I always like to put that first, and you probably all have heard this, but the Pimentel and his students did a study in 2005, I don't know if it's been updated, where he looked and added up all the costs of non-native species, about $137 billion per year. A very small portion of that was given to the marine environment. Why? It's because we don't really have good records. And it's very confusing. Think of a boat. The boat has native and non-native fouling organisms on it. You take off the non-natives, how much is that worth? What is it worth your time? Because you have to clean it off anyway, whether it was native or non-native. So it's just very complicated. Human health is more, not so much the marine, again, more terrestrial and fresh water. The social impact, certainly loss of jobs, affecting fishermen, and loss of recreation. And here you see what doesn't really look like a foot of algae on a beach. I believe it's Harwich or Harwichport. And for a couple of weeks, it's closed until they plow it out and make a sand dune out of it so it will go away. But then it comes back the next year because they polluted the area with runoff from sewage, from their septic systems. Not deliberately, of course, but it happens over time. And there's a sill that keeps the nutrients in there, and so each year this perpetuates itself. Nonetheless, it is a non-native species, and it causes a problem. And then finally, the ecological impacts. And I'll talk a little bit about ecological engineers that have sort of a significant impact in terms of herbivory and predation. Make a new word here. But I first thought I would talk a little, give you a little bit of a clue about the vectors, the way that species get here. And I am talking primarily about human-assisted vectors. You can see there's a whole list of them. The two that are, of course, most important and tend to be talked about the most are ballast water and hull fouling. Now, fouling organisms are growing on hard surfaces, and if you take care of your boat, you're in fine shape. If you don't, you have something like this Canadian who left his boat in the water for a very long time, and it's completely covered with sea squirts, tunicates or ascidians. And the other important thing is you can see a little bit of the propeller there. That also would be an area where you would likely, even for people who take care of their boats, to see non-native or native species, fouling species growing. And when my husband had a boat, every time he'd take it out, I'd say, oh, look at that one, and look at that one, and look at that one. So they were always there. Anytime you move from point A to point B, you're taking it with you. The other big area, and the major interest over the last probably 30 years or more, both nationally or internationally from the International Maritime Organization and from the U.S. Coast Guard, Canadians, who also played a fairly major role, was the dealing with ballast water. These are ballast water discharges that takes about 24 hours for a ballast water tank of this size, which is about 200,000 gallons, to discharge and to pick up water. And where do they take them and pick them up? You're in a harbor. Your harbor has a lot of nutrients. It has a lot of algae and plankton growing in the water column. And they come and they drop it in Boston Harbor. And what is Boston Harbor? A harbor with a lot of nutrients. And so you're transferring from one habitat to another. So for a long time, they say, well, what can we do? We really need to get the commercial boaters to do something about this. So because they don't have any technologies right now, and they still, they're finally working on them, but this was like 30 years ago. And it isn't that people haven't thought about it. There was a reason why they haven't developed them. They said, well, let's at least exchange water in the ocean. So that is what they did. They made, eventually it was first voluntary, and then it was forced. that they had to exchange this ballast water in the ocean. Now, what does it do? It uses a lot of energy. It does interfere with safety because the ballast is keeping the boat stable during rough seas, and it takes a long time. So finally, they said, okay, the reason we don't have technologies, we've got a lot of clever people out there. You can use chlorine, you can use osmium, you can use have a way of making the ballast tank totally anoxic. You can filter, you can centrifuge, and they've tried all of these. The one I liked the best was they used UV light. You have to get a really thin layer, so they did this for about 2 days, and the whole thing froze because they forgot it was marine, and salt water does what? Corrodes, and they didn't use the proper metals. But in any event, it would be very difficult to make that one work permanently. So finally, the U.S. came up, and this went through, again, another five-year period of management, looking at what would take to kill organisms in the marine environment, or what level of organisms you would accept. So if they're very small, you were allowed to have 10 organisms in a cubic meter of water. Okay? Can you visualize that now for that 200,000-gallon tank, difficult this is to achieve? So the phytoplankton on the right, and your left, sorry, are probably fitting in this as well as bacteria and viruses and so forth. These are the adults that you might find in ballast water, and they're in the larger frame, and they would be from 50 to 10 micrometers, and they are less than 10 per milliliter. And then, of course, you have larvae from all of the other adult animals that are on for most of the other animals that we find in the fouling areas. And these standards now have set the stage, and they're finally beginning to develop some ballast water programs or some ballast water technologies to address this issue. So a lot of effort has gone into this, but as often happens, you have a sewage treatment plant, you treat the sewage, but you still have runoff coming into the system, and you still have pollution. The same thing with ballast water. It's only one of the sources that are bringing organisms into the system. The other is the boats and the hulls on both recreational and commercial vessels. So these black dots are part of a Canadian study where they went out and interviewed people who had boats. And they said, where do you go in the summertime or whenever you're traveling? And indeed, they go all the way to Europe, part of Africa, South America, Caribbean, and a lot of the North American coast. The point is that even recreational boats, clean as they are, still have valves or have animals living on parts of them, and they get transported around. So we still have not figured out, at least in the marine environment, how to deal with this. All of these are human-related, and that's what I've always said. All of this is human-related. Guess what? Do you know what this? How many of you know what this is? Remember the tsunami in Japan? This is one of the four floating docks that they had, made out of cement, about 20 feet, I believe, in this direction here, and maybe 60 to 80 feet or 100 feet that direction. These things float. One of them floated ashore in Olympia, and when it did, scientists went all over it, headed up by a man named Jim Carlton, and a lot of taxonomists and people who were just interested, and they came and they removed 400 pounds of animals and plants from these boats. Now, this is one of four. One came ashore, and then it went back out to sea and has been lost. One was never seen, and one sort of skimmed by Hawaii, and it's also not seen, probably somewhere in this big Pacific gyre out there. Now, these things are huge. If you can read the New York Times from a satellite, you have no idea why you cannot find these, but they haven't. Nonetheless, a lot of other fouling debris came in. One was a boat with actual fish in it, believe it or not, made it across the ocean and survived. And the long and the short of it is that there were over 400 species that they have identified to date. How many of those do you think have become established? Nobody knows. You know why? Because to establish, it takes years and decades. And so there's a process, you know. And I've talked about one vector, or two vectors really, mostly, that you have to have the organisms there. They have to be alive. They have to be transported. The population gets established. And like all good populations, they head west, south, north, east. I actually think of the old, or the pioneers going across the country. When we look at how crowded the East Coast is today, and these people were heading out because there were too many people around. Same thing with animals. They spread. And I'll show you a little, few of them that are doing that. Once they become established, it's usually irreversible. There are only a couple of cases where I know of where we've been able to actually eradicate organisms once they've been established. One was algae that was Caulerpa. It's an alga that is used in seawater tanks, thrown into the water, spread, and they send divers out something like 4 years and $4 million by throwing big tarps and Clorox tablets underneath it, killing them, going in and hand-picking them. And, of course, almost any algae that you pick, fragments, settles, and regrows. So it's a real problem. And this gets back to what I said initially, which is it's almost virtually impossible to be able to eradicate species. Well, we in the Northeast, around 2000, had realized that there was some movement abroad on the front of making laws and regulations to deal with ballast water and to deal with marine, or to deal with invasive species and introduced species. I shouldn't say invasive. I forgot to remind you that invasive is a very general term. It doesn't have real quantification around it. So we tend to talk about non-native. The managers tend to talk about invasive because, of course, they have to deal with the actual problems and implementation of trying to clean things up. And it makes much more sense when you have a term like that. But in terms of invasive, invasive is the vine that grows in, or the grapevine that grows in my neighbor's yard, comes over and tries to kill all of my pine trees, but it's a native, you know, and some people love it. And I do too, as long as it stays in his yard. Anyway, documenting non-native species in the East Coast. So we knew about zebra mussels, and they received national attention, but marine invasions were out of sight and out of mind. And most people really still do not know much about the marine environment when you go to the coast. So our goal was to identify what we have in the Northeast, to raise awareness in all of the New England states, and we did that with the program's all writing management plans for both freshwater and marine species. And we used this effort to support efforts to manage invasions at the policy level and so forth. Less probably successful in that area than we were in other areas. The way we did our rapid assessment surveys, we'd bring together 10 to 20 scientists who were able to identify both the native and non-native species. We chose floating pontoons. And why do you suppose we chose those? What happens during the day? Two low tides and high tides. You have 1 hour around low tide to sample. So you can't sample at low tide. So as these floating docks go up and down, whenever you're reaching down and grabbing things, you're always at the same place in the water, no matter which site you're at and what time of the day it is in terms of the tides. And we were interested only in the macro algae and the macro invertebrates. We identified as many species as we could in the field. We brought them back to the laboratory. We archived them and vouchered them, and they're all at the Museum of Comparative Zoology. And we developed a searchable database. All right. So these are the areas. We went to northern Maine, mid-Maine or central Maine. Sometimes they've abbreviated it as a C. New Hampshire and northern Massachusetts, southern Massachusetts and Rhode Island, Long Island Sound. We found 51 species that were non-native and 519 native species. So basically one out of every 10 is a non-native species. And I'm going to talk a little bit of organisms in each of these groups. The algae, we had red algae that showed up in almost 100% of our sites. We sampled for 6 years. We visited 112 sites during that time. And at every site, except for maybe two, we had two species of red algae show up. The snail, I'll talk about in a few minutes, two crabs and some sea squirts. So this is just to kind of give you an overview of the environmental conditions from temperature and salinity. As you can see, northern Maine, the temperature is quite low and very different than the other areas, but even there you can see as you go south, the temperatures get warmer. So we're starting in northern Maine and going to Long Island Sound, New York. The salinity was fairly stable throughout. Variation is years when we had a lot of rain or a river that may have come into one of our sites. We kind of missed that in this Long Island Sound area where we had difficulty finding actually marinas in and around the New York area. In any event, fewer species in northern Maine, and I wish I had it. Can you visualize the lights at night in the coast along the and what do you see? Up in the north, it's dark. And as you get down to Portland and down to Boston and down to Long Island Sound, it begins to be all white. Very few species in the north, fewer marinas, fewer people, fewer big vessels coming in. More as you get further down. This is probably somewhat of an anomaly related to the fact that we had such low salinities in some of our sites. And if I probably recalculate this, it will be closer to these. So the further south you go, the more population you have, the more invasive and introduced species you have. Just to, again, remind you, and we'll start to get into some of the organisms. This is a sea anemone called Diadumene lineata. It's found from here all the way down to Florida. And it's part of the cnidarians, which are also hydroids that are found throughout the coast. And we also have Trisillaria anophinata. This one showed up in 2009 and now has spread all the way up to southern Maine and is heading south as well. And I won't be talking about these, but again, these are fairly groups that have a fair number of non-native species in them. As I mentioned, the red algae, the crustaceans, and the ascidians. Relative to the total number of native ascidians, almost half of them are non-native. Really a fantastic number when you think about it. This actually is one of the ascidians, which I'll get to in a few minutes, as well as these which are native and these which are not so native. So I wanted to just give you a good sense of where these things are coming from. Almost a lot of them, over half of them, are coming from the Pacific. And that's kind of unusual because how many of you can visualize the path that would get us from the Pacific here? So what this means is probably a lot of these have already shown up in Europe and that through the European and other pathways coming back here. Other non-native species are from Europe, and then we have some from the Northwest Atlantic in the southern part and from Gulf of Mexico and then some additionally unknowns. When did they come? The first one that arrived was around 1814 and has progress in terms of the numbers of species. So these are new introductions each quarter century. And as you can see, it continues to grow. There's a hiatus here. It was probably due to the war. I'm not really sure. There's also a time when water was starting to be used as ballast. Now, how many of you know what solid ballast is? Anybody? Okay. So the ballast keeps the ship safe. Whenever they were coming over, they needed solid ballast from coming from Europe to here and vice versa. And if they were bringing goods, that was one thing. Often they didn't. On the way back, they would usually stop at this place, which is Nix's Island in Boston Harbor. Sorry, got a mental block there. It's a little lighthouse. It had at one point 12 acres of land around it. The old farmers would bring their sheep out and actually graze on the land around it. The ships would come and take the shale, and eventually you could see a little bit of the land still at low tide, but not much. In addition, there was slate underneath, and they went in and they harvested that as well. The other interesting thing about this, if you haven't taken a Boston Harbor tour, I truly recommend it. This is one of the places where when the sailors were naughty and they were killed, they would hang them on the lighthouse for everybody to see to come on their way in so that they didn't do that again. And then finally, you can see that here where we started to really be paying attention. So we're seeing a lot more. Now, the question is, are we seeing more because there's more people, or are we seeing more because there's more? And we really don't know the answer to that question. A couple of other things that we wanted to look at was how much of these non-native species are there, and what are they doing in terms of biodiversity? How would you all define biodiversity? How do you define it for yourself? You're all looking at introduced species. How do you define it? Number of species? How many say number of species? How many say something else? How many say anything? Did you guys have tea or coffee before you came in here? Come on. All right. So, just as I think invasive is not a very quantitative term, I find biodiversity, personally, very difficult to deal with. So biodiversity to me is not just the number of species you have, it's how that community is structured and put together. And so one of the things that we wanted to know, and this is really very crude data, I wouldn't say it's publishable data, but we wanted to look at what proportion of the biomass in just a small 15-centimeter square at several sites was native and what was non-native. And we were only looking at the living tissue part. So what we did was scrape it off. Students sat there and sorted. They hated me. I think I had probably darts thrown at me at night because I have stains all over the place. What this tells you is, A, it's very diverse. So the purple color, I don't know if you can see the purple, in some cases it's up to 40% of the total biomass was non-native species. In other cases, there's almost none. So it's very mixed. Overall, an average of about 15%. But to me, this is your biodiversity. It's changing the dominance of the species that you find in these systems. The other group, group of organisms that I thought we would spend a little bit of time on is the crabs. And these are some of the ecological engineers in these systems. Both of these crabs tended to live in the intertidal area. The Asian shore crab actually lives between the intertidal zone, the low intertidal zone, and the mid zone. The green crab is usually found further in the water, as well as upstream and in salt marshes. In terms of their impact, they've been significant. The green crab was here in 1814. It was one of the first species that had been identified. It is a predator and particularly likes soft-shell clams and has been a real problem the last few years in Maine. And that was kind of curious because it's always been around. It's been a problem for a lot of years, but it seems to be particularly worse. So they did some genetic studies and discovered the other problems that we have with introduced species, and that is they can come over more than once. So it turns out there is a introduction of the crab that is a little bit more tolerant of colder waters, and so it's been giving and growing quite successfully in Maine and is actually a real problem and causing them a lot of cost. The one problem with this is really still a new time period, and if you know anything about crabs, they're like this. We had a student who wanted to do a study, marked his crabs, put them back. He was going to clean out, it's actually a pond in Martha's Vineyard, wanted to clean it out. So he marked his crabs, put them back in, went back to retrieve them, and realized he was going to be doing this for the rest of his life. There are a lot of crabs out there. So these are very, very productive organisms. They're very much of an ecological engineer, and they also have problems, cause problems for the shell fishermen. In Massachusetts, in the Cape, they tend to cage their young by putting netting over it or put them up on stilts. It's not perfect, but it helps. The Asian shore crab is fairly new. It came in about 1980. You can find it in rocky areas where the sand underneath is kind of gravelly. And if you have friends and you have to babysit, send them out and have them collect them. Now, if it were me, I would say, it's an invasive species, throw it in the garbage and don't let it go back. But if I took my kids to the beach, I'd say, throw the crabs back, because that's what we do. All right, and I'll tell you about one more crab. Who knows what this one is? the Chinese mitten crab, all right? Chinese mitten crab is a delicacy in Taiwan. Gave a talk there once, and I said, whoa, we were trying to get rid of them. They go, oh, what? They pay hundreds of dollars. Well, they pay $45 a pound for these things. It's illegal to bring them into the States. It has shown up in the Hudson River, and you can tell that it's a crab, a unique crab, because it has this very hairy thing on its claws. Okay? It also has a very interesting lifestyle. it lives in fresh water as an adult, so it can be up in these streams. It goes several hundred kilometers upstream, so it's quite possible, and I would say any of you who are out looking around the Connecticut River or in this area, if you find a carapace, please let me know. We're trying to see if it's showing up anywhere else. It's a very cryptic organism. It's usually in the mud during the day. You rarely see it. It burrows into the banks. There's large holes, and it helps to corrode the banks. But the other part of its life cycle is that it goes back to the sea to breed. The larvae develop in the ocean, and then the young metamorphose back into a megalophia, and then go back after a megalophia, and then go back upstream. And if I had done this, I would have shown you that there are many, many instars and obviously metamorphoses before they get back into a phase where they're going to crawl back up. So again, you know, it just underscores why it's so difficult for us in the marine environment to get rid of these species. The other organism that's also very common, how many of you know this one? Are you not? Does anybody go to the coast, please? Yeah, all right. This is the periwinkle litterina litteria. It also was here, came in around 1840 in Pictou, Nova Scotia, and made it down the coast in about 30 years. Now, I tried to put in a slide that showed a coastal current. There is a coastal current that comes down the coast. So you can see where, again, the larvae would be able to kind of ride the stream down and begin to settle down the coast. This whole area has quite interesting circulation patterns, but the coastal current certainly does. The interesting thing, though, is that those crabs I showed you, and particularly the Asian shore crab, which has been here in 1980, has now made it all the way up to this part of Maine. And so the question is, how does the crab, which is not going to be able to crawl up that many kilometers, go up against the coastal current, but it does. All right, and then finally, the ecological impacts of these organisms. If you look at the sort of simplified food web of the coast, you see we have bivalves, barnacles, and algae. These are the guys that are sitting on the hard surfaces. You have a predatory snail, Phaeus nucella. I can't remember his genus name right now. The green crab, starfish, and the periwinkle snail. And they all have specific interactions with these organisms. But the periwinkle is really the major herbivore. And in many areas, you can see the rocks are cleared pretty much of all algae, as well as a lot of the barnacles. And the green crab is one of the major predators for the bivalves we've talked about already, both in the intertidal areas as well as the sandy areas. So it's very ubiquitous. The other group that is really a nuisance, and one that's sort of surprising in the sense of its success, is it has a larval stage, but the larvae only last for about 2 to 24 hours in the intertidal or in the ocean. So you wouldn't think that it would be able to go very far in that period of time. But just to give you a sense of what the sea squirts are like, these are basically a big bag of water. They have a branchial basket. The branchial basket is full of mucus. It collects all of the particles and the algae and the food that they want, brings it down to the stomach, goes around the stomach, and out the excrement siphon. And you can see that they also reproduce. They reproduce during a period in the summer. So if I were an aquaculturist and I wanted to get rid of this, when would I want to try to get removals of the species? Before it reproduces, okay? So this is one of the reasons why we try to understand what's going on in these systems and how we can manage these. And in fact, that is some of the things that the fishermen are beginning to do. And I'll just For my thesis work, I used to study urchins. I was out in California with the purple urchin, Strongylus introtus purpuratus, that the fishermen would say, oh, these guys are eating all of our kelp because they grew kelp, but we'll break them up. And they kept breaking them up and breaking them up. Well, guess what? What do they do in the water? Fertilize their eggs. So they were releasing sperm and eggs, and they were making more. So the bottom line is you really want to make sure you know what you're doing before you try to get rid of something. All right, I've digressed. The other part of this is the encrusting sea squirts, which this is one of my favorites. I just love this guy. It's called the Trillis schlosseri. It has those little star-like things. Each one of those little white things are an individual zooid. It's about the size of a pencil lead. What's interesting about this, of course, this is basically a clone, because these guys can reproduce asexually as well as sexually. And all sea squirts have a tunic around them, so it protects the larvae until they're ready to release them, and it protects them from a lot of predation. And that's probably one of the reasons why they've been so successful. This is perhaps the most notorious of all of the encrusting organisms, and you can see how successfully it covers mussels in this case. There's a little opening. Guy's still alive. Tentacles. The fishermen have a nice name for these things. They call this snot when they pull it up in their nets. And these tentacles break off and they can settle and recolonize. What's interesting about this organism is it has covered about 90% of 2.5 kilometers out in Georgia's Bank. Now, what's Georgia's Bank? Well, you guys have to know this. This is where a lot of your fish the cod fishery was really very extensive. And the other organism that's out there are scallops. Now, this scallop is about this big. This is a huge scallop. So when you get scallops that are this big, they're coming from usually Georgia's Bank. And initially, the fishermen had fished them out, but they now have a rotating system, so they let them grow up in some areas and not other areas. There are two things that are interesting. One is this, as I said, 90% of 200 kilometers is a lot of area. When they have given a piece of plastic that has didendrum on them and a plain piece of plastic, and they let the larvae of the scallops, the bay scallops, settle, they always settle on the plain plastic, never on the didendrum. There's nothing that we have as a major predator for this organism. The fish don't like it, and so they don't tend to eat underneath, which is where all the worms are that still are alive. So there is life and oxygen underneath this system. And you can see that it's actually out in the rather parts of the coast, not Georgia's Bank, but out near Nantucket as well, but certainly not as prolific as it is there. All right. This organism was interesting because we first found it in 2000. Whoa, look at this. We found something new. Turns out, from a fly and from a sample that somebody had at the Bigelow Lab, it's been around since 1980. Subtract 1980 from 2000 and you get what? How many years? It has been on the coast and no one saw it. Hence my point, out of sight and out of mind. We have a lot of people working on the coast, a lot of investigators thinking about what's going on, and they don't pay attention. All right, made my point, I hope. The other point I wanted to make is this is a mussel sock or a string of mussels covered with Siona. This is another set of mussel socks. You see some of these get broken off. And what happens is that these sea squirts, what are they full of? Water. And what happens when you pick up gallons of water? Heavy, right? All right, so just think of these as gallons of water hanging on these ropes that were not meant to have that much weight. So they bring them down into the muds, kill their mussels, and so forth. So it's been a real problem. The other interesting part of it is this is in Prince Edward Island, where they're potato farmers. So the reason they are so successful at growing their mussels, because all of the runoff comes off, produces the plankton and the phytoplankton, zooplankton that they eat, but it also produces the food for the invaders. So, okay, next slide. All right, so we're going to go and sort of now talk about a little bit about climate change, and then we'll finish up. Basically, the concern is, of course, these range shifts. So one of the students, one of Larry Harris's students, took a look at his slides from 30 years ago and looked at the communities, and they were full of mussels and sponges and bryozoans. And then she looked at the same sort of plates that she was putting in the water, the same size, same place, 30 years later, and finding that they were full of a lot of the non-native species, specifically specifically the Didymnum and some of the other ones that I was showing you. Bottom line is, this community has shifted as a result either of climate change, or in this case probably as a result of these non-native species. But we're also interested in what kind of range expansion we have, both of native and non-native, and how they're going to continue to interact, as well as whether there are long-term effects. And we don't have those records. You know, for example, we've never seen an organism go extinct, at least in this region, as a result of non-native species. Have any of you in your field that you've done or you know about from your readings? Dan? No? Yeah. So it's a real issue. Anyway, what we're interested in, what are these areas of transition and how are they being impacted? The other, just before I go on, one last thing about these Didymnums and some of the other species. Almost all of these white area are Didymnum. This is coral, native coral. Here's some patches of the other encrusting organisms that we find in the area. And this is just on a native surface. So it's not just these floating pontoons where you have a lot of boats coming in, but these organisms now have spread to a lot of our sort of native areas. All right, in terms of climate change, this graph has got to be one of my all-time favorites. I wish I could do graphs like this. This tells me so much about what's going on in the Gulf of Maine. So this is actually one buoy out in Mass Bay. It is near the outfall, for those of you who know anything about Boston Harbor. And there are three or four things that it tells me. The blue line is the average temperature in the winter and the summer from 2001, June 2001, to the present, 2017. The yellow lines, or the yellow space, is the highest and the lowest daily temperature at that site, or at that day, all year long. So you can see that there were some very warm periods, some very cold or colder periods. The orange are today's daily temperatures, or the daily temperature of this year for this buoy. And what can you tell me about it? Warmer? Yeah, definitely. If you look at last year, you see the same thing. And more importantly, if you look at the fall, you see how it's coming down. What this says now is that any organism that couldn't live at this temperature, but could live at this temperature, can now come into the area. And if we look at what's happening all over, we recognize that, you know, from the predictions, our temperature in 2070 is likely to be that of North Carolina. So we can start to look for species from North Carolina moving northward, and we're starting to begin to see some of that, not necessarily coming into New England. There are several things here. You can see that the temperature has increased by about 2 degrees since 1970. The other interesting thing that I wanted to point out for our area, if you look, we have about 51 non-native species. If we looked at the Mediterranean, what do you see? 900? And why do you suppose that is? Climate in part, the canals, and the fact that they actually spend money and have people go out and take a look to see what they have. But actually, it's a more tropical system, you're correct. And then, same with Europe and with the West Coast, they have much higher concentration. Part of that also is probably that we have a broader range for organisms to have to survive in, because most organisms reproduce at various temperatures. And then finally, we're looking to the opening of the Arctic Passage as another source of potential organisms coming through from Europe and this area. And finally, something called, we call mid the summer transients, and I'll show you those in a minute. What we're not calling range expanders, though, are organisms like Fastia siphonia, Drotolupia turritura, and this very lovely little shrimp with blue on its claws that have just come to the area, and they're doing their range expansion all by themselves. They're the ones that are moving west, young man, kind of organisms. What we do look at, though, are those organisms that have been around for a long time, like the sea squirt Botryloides schlosseri, which has been around since 1858, and you can see how it has moved north into Canada over various periods of time. And you can see some of the newer introductions are also moving north, having stabilized in our area. And then finally, the summer transients. How many are familiar with the lionfish? Did you know that it's found in Long Island Sound occasionally in the summertime? Good. Watch TV. Nice. And the other organism that we found in Woods Hole actually was a tropical, this is a worm, Hydroides worm, Hydroides elegans, and it survived over one of the winters because that winter didn't go particularly low. It went to about 10 degrees centigrade, and it was enough to keep the organism alive. The other interesting thing is it came in at the same time as this organism, which is called Tricellaria inopinata. It's an animal, and it is the one which has spread fairly far. One of the last things I wanted to bring up was, I know one of your last speakers is talking about non-native species as food sources, and I wanted to put in a plug for, that's not an excuse for letting these organisms come in. Once they're here, sure, if you need to try to use them as food, you can. They tried to do that with the green crab. They tried to breed it so that they could get the soft shell crab, and it doesn't, like they do with the blue crabs out of Chesapeake, and it doesn't work because their breeding cycle doesn't give you a period where they're all molting at once. They mold at different times, so there's never a time where you can go out and collect soft-shell crabs. Nonetheless, I've seen them for sale in the markets in New York City. In this case, these are another sea squirt called Diella clava. It is something that the fishermen, again, giving it their name, call sea potatoes, and they can grow to be about this big. And they are actually grown and eaten in Korea. And in fact, we recently had a tunicate meeting in Woods Hole. A chef from Hawaii who was from Korea came, cooked these for us. And I wish I could find the slide of a friend of mine from Israel who said, oh, I'll taste one, pop it in her mouth, and immediately spit it back out. It was just the most beautiful face in the world. Somebody got a picture of it. The bottom line is, of course, these are acquired tastes. He came saying, well, you've already got it. Why don't you grow it? And we could use it, and we could transport it back. No one has taken him up on that. It would be probably hard to manage in this area. It is a delicacy in many areas, as I said. And this is John Bishop from England and Rosa Roca from Brazil, who are showing these fishermen how you cut it open, what part you eat of this particular organism. And by the way, if you do eat Korean food, and there's a peculiar taste, we did all taste it from the cooking that the chef had done. And there's a taste in that, their soups, and it's the powdered sea squirts that they add to it. So, you know, if you have that peculiar taste, you now know what it is. And the Japanese, of course, do some of the same thing. All right, so I've really made the point. It's really hard to get rid of organisms. The best thing we can do is prevent bioinvasions in the marine environment. It took us decades to pass the ballast water regulations. The biosecurity here in the U.S. for marine organisms is really very fragmented, and we really need to work very hard to get them to do a better job. It's really kind of out of our hands. Haul filing still remains a problem. Aquaculture and seafood are still managed by multiple agencies, but at least they are managed. There is something called the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force, and some of you might also be interested in the Northeast Aquatic Nuisance Species Panel. It focuses more on freshwater and marine organisms, but if you're interested in this area at all, that would be perhaps of interest. We have no commitment for haul inspections. The only good news is that we're required to take your boats upshore whenever you bring them in for putting new fouling paint on, and that guarantees that you're not putting organisms back in the water. And then finally, our research funding here is really pathetic compared to almost any country, including Europe, which has, had a much worse downturn in the economy than we did, and yet they've put $60 million into research for non-native species in the marine environment alone. And they made it a requirement that all the countries have to have a listing of what species they have and to make sure that they're not trading things with other countries. So there's a lot that goes on. It's just not much is going on in the U.S. right now. And so we have been somewhat successful. I think the Coast Guard's done a great job of dealing with ballast water, but that's just one part of the picture. We need to streamline some of our regulations. Ooh, does that sound like what some of the people are talking about? But it really does need to be done so that the agencies work together a little better. The Fish and Wildlife Service did do one of the things that we had talked about several years ago, and that is to reestablish a national database for what comes in. Right now, they lump carp in with koi, with goldfish, and say this many pounds of fish are coming in. Beg your pardon? Now, what's going to the aquaculture? What's going to the fish markets? What's going to the ornamental markets? So they're beginning to pull that apart, and it's certainly not something that you can't do. And then they're raising awareness, really, is something that we really keep needing to do. All right. With that, there are thousands of people that have been involved with these studies. I want to thank all of them. Thank you for listening. And we've been really fortunate. The scientists who work with us volunteer their time. We pay for room and board when they go out on these surveys, but otherwise they're all giving of their time, and we find that very helpful and appreciative of that. In addition, a number of places have given us their labs to use during the summer, and as you can see, perhaps, yes, this was New York, I think, and what we end up doing is people lie across the boards, reach down, grab things, and we have had a good time doing it. And then finally, if any of you are more interested, there is a book that I published a while ago. You can go online and get it. So, any questions? You guys are a very quiet group. Yes, sir.
Do you have one single location on the coast that's only aligned with MIT, or is just MIT orchestrating a process?
No, we don't have. MIT is on fresh water. We're on the Charles River, and we do not own a marine lab. So when we do these surveys, we do them at marinas up and down the coast. There's a lot of other data here. We've been looking at, for example, the five sites that we visited each year to see how things change, and it's very variable. Populations come and go. But why did you ask that?
Well, maybe in Portland you had a central biological center, marine center that
yes.
Or Northern Park or something in New Hampshire or something. I didn't know where you operated at.
Well, we do work, the places that we go in Maine, the people there have been very receptive. So one's in South Freeport, one's in Portland, and we've gone back to those marinas, I think, four times. We've gone to the University of New Hampshire field station several times, and Larry Harris is a professor there, so he's and the phycologist Art Matheson also works there. So we certainly involved as much as we could local people, but for taxonomists, there aren't very many around. And we end up going out to California to get our Ascidian taxonomist and down to Brazil to get somebody who studies hydroids. And if you look at the average age, most of it is around 60, 65. So it's a real problem because without, the didymnum, which has been one of the major invaders in this area, we didn't see it until 2000, 20 years later. So we really need to get people out there.
Yeah, I want to follow up on a comment about we didn't see it until 20 years later. How do we know? They had dates when they arrived and when they detected.
Well, so they know. There's a little bit of a controversy about how that one came in. It could have either come in by ballast water, or it could have come in when somebody tried to bring oysters in for a fishery from Asia. Okay, and so the Indian tribes had tried to do that aquaculture, and that was sometime in the mid-80s. And a little bit before that, somebody from the Bigelow Labs in Maine had taken a sample and kept the sample. So these voucher samples are really important. They can go back, they can take a look at it, dissect it, say, yep, this is a didendum. The interesting thing, and the point I think I hope I made, and I'll make it again, is one of the reasons we want to stop things from coming in is when you go to Japan, as one of the students did, to try to identify that the species we have is related to the one in Japan, she couldn't find it. She had to go back for two visits or three visits before they actually found it. It is just part of the native community, and it's a very small part of it. It's not really super abundant and super prolific like it is here. So this is one of the problems, and this is why we are so, I guess, insistent on that. But it's a good question.
I was just wondering about the that sock thing. What was it called? With the water, the squirt thing.
Okay. So a sock is just a long netting, and they start out with small muscles that get attached to ropes. And you know muscles have abyssal thread. You're familiar with that? And you know dentists have looked at that to see if that's the kind of glue that they can use to keep your fillings in. I have lots of fillings, so I was always interested in that when my dentist told me about it. But anyway, so they stick on pretty strongly to these things. And then as they grow, they put them onto sometimes bigger and bigger nettings. But when they're small, they put them in a little sock. As they get bigger, they're more or less attached to the rope, and they can take those nettings off. So I still call them socks. So it's just a long rope with muscles attached to them and growing, and then they'll pick them off, put them in, you know, containers, and they'll sell them. But when the sea urchins or when the sea squirts come, then they grow right on top of them because they attach. It's not a predatory relationship because they both survive, actually. The mussels are able to feed. But you have now this mass of water that holds, that weights these things down. And so that's the biggest problem. There may be some detriment to their feeding, to the feeding of the mussels, but they're feeding on two different things. The sea squirts tend to feed on a smaller portion of the plankton than the mussels do. But, of course, the physical, you know, when you see that sock being pulled out, you have to remember these sea squirts will, you know, let themselves hang out a little bit more. It's just that weight of water that's coming down. Yes?
Trying to regulate this ballast water on transport ships going all along the East Coast seems like a pretty daunting task. Are these regulations measurably effective?
They were measurably effective in a couple of ways. So once they forced the ship owners to do this exchange of ballast water at sea, they said, hey, you know, why should we be sending it out? Why not transfer it to another ballast tank? So they do an awfully lot of ballast tank transfers now without actually putting things out. In terms of trying to be effective, it's hard to say. And the reason is, I don't know how much you know about plankton, but plankton often collect together. So you will have a swarm here with your AV guy and maybe another swarm over here. Now you're going to sample 5 times in this big ballast water tank here, and there's got a swarm here and a swarm here, and you sample all in here. So we don't really know how effective some of these techniques are because it's very hard to figure that out. And it's hard to say that we've been effective when we keep seeing new species coming in. So I just don't know. I don't know whether they've been here and we're just now seeing them and whether the ballast water is effective. Where it has been effective is in the Great Lakes. And why is that? You go through a canal, and so you can have people on Canadian side and the U.S. side checking boats, checking, you know, the logs that the ship has to keep now to show that they've exchanged water or treated it or done what they're supposed to do. And if they don't like it, they can send it back. The only other place that I know they do that is in Australia, and that's because they had this sea star come in as larvae, and it completely decimated their shellfish beds in one of the harbors. And now they will stop boats. If they don't like what's on your hull, or if they don't like what's in your ballast water because you haven't done what you're supposed to do, they won't let you come in. They can go out and stop. But we're not very good at that yet, except for the Great Lakes. Thank you. And thank you.